Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. The Fed bounce and bobble. Stocks initially jumping after the central bank chair said a rate hike was unlikely to be its next move, but the rally losing steam into the close. What sparked that pullback, and is this just a sign that the volatility is not behind us? Plus, sinking Starbucks, the stock falling nearly 18% at the lows of the day. The CEO getting to a very testy exchange with Cramer this morning. Is there any reason to still be bullish on this stock? We'll talk with one analyst who's holding on to their buy rating. And later, Pfizer shares catch a bid after earnings. New York Community Bank surprises investors with a clear path to profitability. And big moves from Qualcomm and Zillow in the after hours. We're breaking down all the results. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Steve Grasso, and Michael Kontopoulos, Director of Fixed Income at Richard Bernstein Advisors. Welcome, Michael. And we start off with that boomerang action in stocks after the Fed news conference. The S&P initially soaring more than 1%, but pulling back sharply in the last hour of trading to close in the red. The Nasdaq had been up nearly 2% at the highs, also finished lower. Rates, meantime, also ricocheting with the two-year falling more than 10 basis points at the lows as Chair Powell seemed to take a rate hike mostly off the table, but yields climbing off those levels. For more on what came out of the central bank, CNBC's Steve Leisman joins us now. What was your overall take? In terms of hawkish, dovish,
a little bit more hawkish than expected, yeah. Melissa. I think maybe the market maybe dodged a bullet. The Fed, they kept rates unchanged throughout the quarter to 5.5. That was expected, but it was silent about what impact stalled inflation progress would have on policy. The statement did note that stalled progress, but markets, I think, they dodged that bullet with no explicit mention in the statement of a change to policy because of those hotter inflation readings. And then more importantly, Powell, for his part at the press conference, said it was possible there could be no rate cuts this year. So that's on the hawkish side. But also said, as you just said, Melissa, rate hikes were, quote, unlikely. And said he still expects inflation to come down with rates where they are.
My expectation is that we will, over the course of this year, see inflation move back down. That's my forecast. I think my confidence in that is lower than it was because of the data that we've seen.
And the Fed surprised markets with a more aggressive reduction in the balance sheet runoff than expected. The Fed had been reducing its treasury holdings by $60 billion a month, but next month that's going down to $25 billion a month, the mortgage-backed security numbers remaining unchanged. That provides a little relief for a treasury market that's really been awash in new supply since the Fed will be runoff will be reduced. But at least it, in part, counters overall monetary policy designed to keep financial conditions tight, Melissa.
I thought that was a great question that you asked in terms of the reduction of the balance sheet and what that would mean in terms of the policy efforts that the Fed was doing. And he seemed to sort of dismiss it, that it was never meant to be, providing accommodation to the economy, basically. Do you buy that, though?
Well, the Fed, and I think some of the smarter guys and folks I've talked to in the markets, Melissa, have this idea that quantitative easing has a profound effect when you're buying treasuries, but the effect is less when you're selling them, or letting them run off. And I think that's proven to be true so far. We'll see. But I think what we're seeing here is concern about liquidity in markets and not having the kind of hiccup we had in 2019. That seems to be an overriding concern with the idea that they're not really, at least they believe, they're not giving up very much in the inflation fight from reducing this runoff. By the way, it is still running off.
Mm-hmm. Steve, it's Karen. First of all, great job last night. Steve's band played at the Council for Economic Education event. He was fantastic.
As he is.
So that was really good. So I was surprised by the magnitude of the market's reaction, both up and down. Was it just euphoria? Was it seemingly not as bad as we thought it could have been? And what sort of changed the tone?
Yeah, so maybe
the market's reaction.
Maybe it's not really very humble to quote myself, but I said that there was only downside risk today I said this earlier before the for the markets, depending upon how aggressively they have already priced the downside risk, the market really did has a bit of a sell-off. Yields have come up quite a bit. So I think there was a little bit of relief out there, Karen, overall. I'm not sure about what happened at the end of the day that Melissa was talking about. But I think there's a little bit of relief. It could have been worse. And I actually think the question I asked Powell about his essentially his confidence in inflation coming down is really sort of what you might call the money quote here. He is still confident in the progress that the rate is set at a restrictive enough level to bring inflation down over time. And what you need to do, I think, is reset your clock, but I don't think you have to reset essentially the time zone that you're in, right? By which I mean the cuts will happen and happen over time, but just over a longer horizon than previously believed.
Okay. A lot. I mean, that's everything, though, to the markets, isn't it, Tim? I mean, if we have to reset, if we're still in the, I don't know about this time zone clock.
Yeah, it's not a great metaphor, Melissa.
But,
it's not great. But
I mean, to say, it's coming. I just can't tell you when. I mean, I understand that's what the Fed's, you know, prerogative is, and that's what they need to do at this point. But for markets, it's not. That's not very comforting, I don't
think. Well, I would think that the guy that's quoting himself would actually not tell us it was a bad metaphor. But, you know, Steve, I guess my question ultimately is, what did Powell tell us about the economy? I understand the statement is, you know, word for word, and you know, but the equity market cares a lot more about that. Yes, we pushed out some rate cuts, as we're all saying, whether it's mid-25, you get your third cut, or whether it happens maybe at the end of the, you know, I mean, I actually think the equity market doesn't want to see that by the end of the year. What did we hear about the economy? Because stagflation is the word of the week,
and I want to understand
what you think.
No, Tim, just forget that word. This is not stagflation.
My word. I'm just saying
forget
it's somebody's
it.
Word.
It's one guy's word, and it's and really, it is so inappropriate for the situation we're facing now. Tim, weren't we in Russia together, Tim?
Yes, we were.
What was inflation in Russia?
I think it ran in three or four digits.
Sometimes it ran in three digits.
This is like
digits.
The 80s, right?
We were younger men.
Uh-huh. In the 90s.
What was
inflation? Okay. When we had stagflation in this country, what was inflation? It was 10%. We are talking about the difference between 2 and 3% inflation. That's the first thing. We're talking about unemployment that's running below 4%. We're talking about growth. Forget the GDP overall number at 1.6. Growth, real final domestic purchase at 3%. We have decent growth. We have low unemployment, and we have inflation that's running above target, but certainly not inflation that's out of control in a way that makes you worry about stagflation. Is the economy cooling? That's the hope. That's what we all wanted, Tim. What is a soft landing? A soft landing is a reduction in the growth level, maybe a slight rise in the unemployment level, and the ability of the Fed to cut interest rates in response to that. You cannot go from, I don't know what the right word is, from things are a little bit softer to the world is coming apart. And by the way, when you think about stagflation, you're skipping over a major step. The expected response to cooler growth is lower prices. What do you think Starbucks is going to do now that it has the kind of numbers that it had? Is Starbucks going to raise prices further, or is there a possibility Starbucks eases back on its prices? That's what happens in response. If you don't get that response, Tim, then you have to worry about this idea of stagflation and something being wrong in the price mechanism, something being wrong in the response to the economy. I'm sorry to go on a tirade here.
First of all, we're going to have...
I should calm down, I know.
We're going to have a great Starbucks segment later in the show, and I think we should have you back.
Obviously, somehow
I did hit a nerve with the third-person reference not having the good metaphor. But don't kill the messenger. I don't think there's stagflation. I hear you loud. You're absolutely right. Yeah. The economy's not even close also to falling off a cliff, let alone the inflation side of it. I agree.
They said the economy was still growing at a solid pace, and Powell did look through that weaker Q1 GDP number. They said job gains are still strong, and we'll wait to see on Friday, but that is at least the expectation. And overall, you've had decent consumer spending. Look, some of the data has been a little weaker of late, and that's something I think to think about. But what I expect in response to weaker data is weaker price pressure. Period. End of story.
Steve, always great to get your analysis. Thank you.
Yeah, you got me going here, Melissa.
Bad metaphor at all. Steve Liesman, you're nodding your head when Steve said stagflation has no place in this conversation. But investors love to jump to the worst case scenario. Is that the worst case scenario? Is that in the the purview? I mean, is that sort of out there?
No,
just absolutely not.
I 100% agree with Steve. Certainly okay. not over the next 12 to 18 months, let's call it. Mm-hmm. Maybe 3, 5, 7, 10 years down the line, right, when our debt problem becomes such a huge issue and inflation might still be elevated for a lot of demographic type reasons, maybe then you have a stagflationary environment. But that's quite some time.
So what are we facing right now in your view?
Well, listen, I still think we're in reacceleration. Back in March, I said the market would have to price in a hike. I think everybody gave me odd looks when I said that on the panel. And, you know, sure enough, we came into today expecting that a 30% chance of a hike this year, no cuts. I still think we got to go back to that point where the market starts to price in hikes because the economy is strong and inflation continues to surprise to the upside.
Yeah, I think there was probably one of his best press conferences. I think he sort of went out on a couple of different things, but you have QT that's ending, right? So that's QE in effect. And then you have this sort of, I don't want to say it's a Fed put, but maybe it's a Fed put, because if things get worse, he's going to be there. And then what does stagflation have? High unemployment.
That's right.
We don't have high unemployment. So we're very early on that call. All in all, I think the markets usually do the reverse of their first move, and that's mm-hmm. what they did this time.
So May meeting obviously came and went, and there was no cut, Steve. And that
Steve
was
got his cut. Hold on. He got his cut in the tapering.
Maybe.
In the tape, maybe, possibly.
I'm letting Steve back in.
You're letting him in.
Off the
but
ledge.
He was talking
that's
about
true.
Tapering all along. But anyway.
It was what?
You were very, aggressively saying they're going to taper.
Yeah, and plus, I don't like consensus, too, right? When oil was 125, I thought it was going to 65, right? It seemed like a crazy move. I don't know how much they're going to be able to cut, but I know he has to cut in an election year, right. Whether or not he's political or not.
No way.
All right. We're more on the Fed decision, and we can continue this debate here. Let's bring in Tom Michaud, the CEO of KBW, a Stifel company. Tom, great to see you.
Good evening.
Where do you think we are in the economy? Do you think the Fed is doing the right thing at this point?
So what we see through the banking industry's lens is that loan growth was slower than expected in the quarter, and higher interest rates are starting to bite. You can see it in real estate. And so our view is that we see a little bit of a slowdown through the banks and through that lens. But credit quality has been very stable.
I guess that's where I'd love to go with this, because it's earnings season. And actually, by the way, today was a day when banks really outperformed. And I know there's some New York Community Bank news that shot that up. But regional banks, independent of that, were very strong. And yet what we've heard from restaurants, what we've even heard from Visa, but certainly, you know, we're going to have a conversation about the consumer. That lower end consumer is cracking. And it feels like if you listen to the companies, cracking pretty hard. Thoughts? What do you see?
Well, first of all, a lot of that exposure is not in the banking industry.
Yep.
Since Dodd-Frank was passed, the whole idea was de-risk the banking industry. So they've been pushed out of a lot of that underwriting. So I would say that's a lot of that's in private credit and then the non-bank lenders.
Is it cracking or is it normalizing?
Well, it's normalizing, number one. It's normalizing. Exactly. Remember, we just had the 100-year pandemic and a really historic response. So when you look at the numbers, the percentage changes a lot, but it's coming off of zero. We're still away from what's a normal credit expense. And I think that's actually been the surprise, how well unemployment's held in there, number one. And number two, credit's been generally pretty good for the banking industry.
At what point, though, do you start getting concerned that the data points we're seeing about the consumer comes to bite the banking industry? Eventually, the two shall meet, won't they?
I think cycles have not been repealed. It's inevitable. I don't think it's tomorrow, and we don't see anything on the horizon. And the other thing, too, is that when you look at a lot of the banks that do have exposure to the commercial real estate that folks worry about, their reserves are over 10% to those loans right now. Global financial crisis losses to the banks were a little bit lower than that. So the banks have already built a fortress of protection for like the big city mortgage credits.
Are you as confident, though, in private credit and the reserves that they have against commercial real estate?
I think private credit, this will be the first cycle that private credit's gone through. So there'll be winners and losers. I think there's no question about it. And also, too, one thing that it'll never be repealed is if you grow really fast at something, when you take credit risk, you're a little bit more at risk. And there's been a lot of fast growth in many of those markets.
So how do you think about the divergence between the strength of the big money center banks and the fear of the regional banks? Are they, is it too far apart? How do you think this plays out?
That's a great question, because so we have the Keefe Bank Index, which is the BKX, which are the biggest 24, then the KRX, which is the Keefe Regional Bank Index. There's about a 17% difference in year-to-date performance, which is just about as wide as I've seen it. And it's because the flight path for earnings is so different. We feel much stronger about buying large cap bank stocks. And there are a couple of stories that we're really pretty fired up about. Whereas the regional banks are going to have more headwinds because higher for longer might be a little bit more problematic. And they tend to have more commercial real estate exposure. We're not worried about their balance sheets, but there might be some more risk to their earnings estimates.
Is there any scenario where you would choose the smaller cap names, the regional names, because you just touched on where I was going to go. If rates are going to stay high for long, then you have $1 trillion of resets in commercial real estate this year, followed by half a trillion. So we all know the staggering of it. If rates are staying high, is there a scenario where you waste time with the regional?
There are some really good names. Like East West Bank is one of our favorites. This company, with all that we know in our model right now, is a high teens ROE earner, and that's kind of in a tricky environment. They're a very profitable company. Let's say they're about $75 billion in assets. So that's a name, for example, that we like. But the regional banks don't have the big cities. Think three-story office park, medical folks in the building, probably fully leased, much different than downtown San Francisco. So they're not, and then also a lot of those loans have independent guarantees from individuals. Believe me, those folks don't like to walk from their credits.
Tom, great to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Great to be with you.
Tom Michaud, CEO
Thank
of KBW. Karen, in particular, Tim had mentioned your community, but
yes,
you're in this still,
yes,
right?
Yes. Right. No, I just think it is an option now that has life and volatility. And when you have that and they put in a great management team, I don't know if you listened to the call, Tom, but I didn't want to bring
it too late.
Sorry.
Too late.
No, you don't have to.
Anyway, there was a lot to like about that.
Yep. Okay. Now to an earnings alert here. Qualcomm shares rising 4.5% after posting better than expected earnings and revenue. The chipmakers conference call just kicking off a few minutes ago. Christina Parks Nevelis joins us to break down the results. Hey, Christina.
Hi. Well, we know Qualcomm's biggest source of revenue comes from handsets, and sales are up 1%, adding to that smartphone recovery narrative. Management's on the earnings call right now, pointing to premium tier sales. They also said they are not seeing signs of weakness in the Android Chinese premium market. So that helped the better than expected results and upbeat outlook. The company's auto business, although is smaller, is up 35% year over year, while other chip makers like Texas Instruments, onsemi, have all warned of EV weakness. So there was concern going into this report. We can see Qualcomm was able to beat that. On export controls, interestingly, Qualcomm confirming that they have continued to sell products to Huawei under current licenses that they have, but, quote, do not expect to receive product revenues from Huawei beyond the current calendar year. So you could potentially hear more about the competition between both companies going forward. Expect management also to talk about plans to release this AI chip for laptops starting this summer, but we know that won't impact forecasts for a while. But it seems like the focus right now is just on this premium tier market. That's what they're talking about on the earnings call.
Christina, thanks.
Thank you.
Christina Parts Nevelis. There are real concerns after Skyworks yesterday, Tim, particularly when it came to potential Android weakness, which they dispelled.
They did, and they certainly said in the higher end, is which is where they live. It's been an interesting ride for Qualcomm, which has had a pretty good run. It's up almost 15% year-to-date. It's pulled back a little bit into these numbers. Valuation isn't terribly demanding. It certainly exists in the more boring part, you could say, really, of the semiconductor world, but it's a place where I think ultimately there are those waiting to hear how they're going to begin to bolt on some of this AI exposure. So these are numbers that are reassuring. You're right. We've had kind of a mixed landscape. Overall, the group also was a fascinating day because semis really were leading the downside. They were down, you know, over 3.5% at one point intraday. They rallied up to flat on the Fed. And it's like what we talked about with that cha-cha-cha Fed move. They've closed back down. So really interesting to see where the leadership's going to come from.
50% of their revenues are from handsets. 60% of the revenues are from China. So those are two headwinds. So Christina started off saying the recovery of the handset market. So that's the read through to Apple, if we can make that read through. But there's a lot of headwinds concerned with this name, even though it's up 4% after hours.
All right. Coming up, more after hours action to bring you shares of Zillow, DoorDash and MGM all on the move. We'll bring you the details out of the quarters next. Plus, coffee gone cold. Shares of Starbucks notching their worst day since 2020. What the CEO had to say about the coffee chain's quarter and if you should drop the drip from your portfolio. Don't go anywhere. More Fast Money in two.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee, right here on CNBC.
Wouldn't it be great to have all your investment and retirement accounts in one place? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, makes it easy. I use it to put my investment account and 401k accounts into one hub and get expert tips that help me confidently manage my money. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They're the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Two pharma giants topping the tape today, though for different reason. Pfizer up 6% after beating earnings expectations on the top and the bottom lines. The company also hiking its full-year profit outlook, helping shares have their best day since November 2021. Johnson & Johnson also up today. That's after the company announced that it plans to pay $6.5 billion to settle almost all of the lawsuits claiming its talc-based product caused ovarian cancer. That is going to be put up for a vote, so not finalized yet. The stock is up nearly 5%, its best day since last July. These are two stocks that have been beleaguered for different reasons. Are we going to look back on this day and say there has been a change in sentiment, Tim, for your Pfizer slash your J&J too?
Yeah, I own them both. I own both of these beleaguered names, and that's a very polite. But, I haven't really felt that beleaguered in J&J, and, in fact, I've owned it for, 6 months. Ish. And my view is the talc overhang, which we, if in fact you get the 75% acceptability vote on this, which is probably not expected till towards the end of the summer, I think it removes a huge overhang for the stock. Now, it doesn't necessarily change, the kind of meh element of their pharma business, their med tech business, though, which showed a very strong quarter. Remember, we just got numbers from J&J. Those numbers were solid. And I think you're waiting for clarity. This was something that I think is very important. And of the two announcements today, it was great to see Pfizer not really take themselves down, which is what they do every time they report. But I like the J&J news more.
I just think about, we'll get to it, but this medical loss ratio issue that we're seeing again and again has to be good news for the J&Js of the world.
Yes, right. It is. Yeah, you're seeing higher utilization, so there are more devices being bought, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
they said that on their earnings call. Where do you stand on some of these?
Both charts look similar. Obviously, I owned Pfizer for a long time. I don't own it any longer. I think once you got through the pandemic, it became, as we all know, on the desk, a vaccine story. You don't have to be an anti-vaxxer to see that vaccine rates have gone down drastically after we've gotten a couple of years away from the pandemic. So they have to come up with another, even though they're a great company, they have a lot of other things. It was vaccine for them that really moved the needle. Now they have to come up with something to replace it. Neither J&J or Pfizer are playing in that obesity area, and that's what's hot right now.
All right, coming up, earnings season rolls on, and we've got a lot more action to bring you in shares of Zillow, DoorDash, and MGM, the results that have those names moving ahead. And speaking of earnings, shares of Starbucks getting roasted after last night's report. We will filter. There's so many, many
puns.
So many. We'll roll through the results with a bullish analyst and see if there could be a cappuccino comeback in store. You're watching Fast Money live from the Nasdaq in Times Square. Back right after this.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click.
Click, click, click.
Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks losing steam late in the day after an initial post-Fed surge. The Dow, which had been up more than 530 points, closing with just a 90-point gain. The S&P and NASDAQ both losing 0.3%. Shares of CVS dropping nearly 17% after reporting results this morning, notching its worst day since 2009 and its fourth worst day ever. The pharmacy chain missing on the top and the bottom line and slashing its profit outlook as higher medical costs weigh on the insurance space. And more after-hours action to bring you. Shares of DoorDash dropping after an earnings miss. MGM slightly higher after a top and bottom line beat. Shares of Etsy sinking on an earnings miss. eBay also lower on light revenue guidance. And shares of Carvana, this is a big one, surging on a big revenue beat. That stock is trading at more than two-year highs. You see that right, up 28%. In the after hours. I don't know where you want to go because I know Carvana is a big one. CVS is, you know.
Yeah. CVS, there was just a lot to hate. I mean, in so many parts of the business, the medical loss ratio, which we just talked about, that was high. The front of store, that was low. I mean, there really was just all different parts of their business that really weren't working. The only thing to say about it, the valuation is really cheap, but yet this has been happening in slow motion for a really long time. So I don't own it. I'm not inclined to jump in right here.
So when you look at technicals on this name, it traded down to October 2020 levels, and then channeling my inner guy Adami, it looks double toppy if you look back to January high and March. So it looks like it's a bad setup, but if I have to look at a glasses half full, I try to use that October 2020 level, which is right around $54, as a support level and see how long it takes to, you know, either bounce from that level or continue to hold.
All right, coming up, another big move in New York Community Bank, this time to the upside. More on the results and the profitability plan the new CEO is laying out. That is next, and we are diving into the huge drop in Starbucks after earnings. What the CEO had to say about the company and whether you should keep betting on the brew after the fall. Don't go anywhere. More Fast Money in 2.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Starbucks dropping nearly 16% to not just lowest close in almost 2 years. It was the stock's worst percent drop since the start of the pandemic and the biggest dollar decline ever. The drop coming as a result of lousy earnings, the decline in same-store sales across all regions in the first quarter, and a forecast of weakness for several more quarters. Starbucks also slashed its guidance for the rest of the year. No surprise the stock was lower on that. But then the CEO, Laxman Narasimhan, got the chance to make the bull case for Starbucks on Squawk on the Street. That should have helped, right? Not so much. Here's Cramer asking the CEO the very question we have asked here on this desk so many times.
Is it possible that your coffee is just too darn expensive?
Jim, I think that if I look at the U.S. occasional customer, they have clearly cut back on visits to us. If you look at the value for money scores we have, they're still strong. But there's no question that the occasional customer is cutting back on visits to us.
And then there's this. When Jim says the CEO is making a fanciful statement about service, which Jim says is, to put it nicely, lacking.
The speed of service is real. That's a fanciful statement. It's the exact opposite of what is happening. And I don't know how you can say it on our air.
Jim, the facts are we have improved speed of service quarter over quarter.
I think your throughput is awful, sir. And I do not understand how you can say service is good and also say at the same time that throughput is awful.
So, Jim, throughput has improved. There are opportunities for us to improve it even further. And that's what the team is focused on.
I like how Cramer holds his brow. If that wasn't enough, Faber gets in on the action, questioning what the CEO sees in terms of the challenging macro environment when economic indicators say the economy is chugging along.
In terms of citing a deteriorating economic outlook weighing on customer traffic, do you really think that's the case? We talk about it endlessly here, as you well know, and it's far from clear that there really is a deteriorating economic outlook. So what is it you're seeing that perhaps many others are not?
I think what we are seeing is pressures on the wallet for some of our most occasional customers. And they are translating that into what they're choosing to do.
How are, all right, what are they doing then?
Well, so some of them are obviously visiting less, as we have seen, hence our action plan.
An action plan, it seems, that's as much in demand as a $7.25 venti caramel ribbon crunch frappuccino. That's before tax, of course. So is the beating Starbucks has been taking today deserved, or is the bear case overdone? Let's bring in Starbucks bull, B of A Securities, Sarah Senatore. She's got a buy rating on the stock, maintain her $108 price target after last night's report. Sarah, I don't know if you watched that interview live. It was cringeworthy. How much of that is warranted? How much of that is overdone?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't envy Lox for having had to go through that. No, but with that being said, I think, you know, the sell-off is far overdone. So what I will say is, you know, we knew that the Starbucks was going to have some difficulties in terms of same-store sales. They'd already telegraphed that on their last quarter, and we can talk about what I think the reasons for. And China, we know broadly from other restaurants, young brands, for example, that that's just a difficult operating environment right now. So from my perspective, when a stock sells off the way it did, you know, it typically means it's not just a question about the near term, because obviously guidance was lowered 15% down to sort of low single digit to flat, but questions about the longer term viability of the brand. And I think those are misplaced.
In terms of, I mean, to get to Kramer's point about costs, though, what can, are there any levers to pull on that aspect to bring price down, or is that something that just remains elevated because of the nature of labor costs and inflation remaining high in general?
Well, I'll start by saying, you know, the order that you referred to, right, there's a lot of customization in there when you have caramels and ribbons and crunch, right? So a lot of what you've seen in terms of the price is actually consumers deciding to really customize their order. So when we look at the amount of price that Starbucks has taken on a like-for-like basis, really isn't very high relative to what we've seen from others. So, you know, they're this right now, it's about 2% higher than it was last year. There are very few restaurants that only have 2% price. So you're looking at a check that is really a function of what consumers want. And I think what Starbucks is offering is, you know, they're offering some targeted offers through their loyalty, through their app, to really get at that. So whether it's a, you know, BOGO or 50% off in the afternoon, that's what they're doing to really make that occasion very, you know, sort of very accessible.
So when I think about the CEO Lachman's tenure so far, almost from the moment he took over, the results have totally missed what they've told us. I think there's been a very poor communication in the market, and I guess it just gets back to Starbucks versus the consumer, because we all know that the lower end consumer, we've heard from McDonald's, we've heard from Mondelez that they need to lower, you know, chocolate chip cookies. I mean, there's a lot of different things going on, but Starbucks should be somewhat immune. I just think about the management team here. And yesterday's, you know, the CFO is the mea culpa was kind of bizarre. Like, you know, this was an awful quarter. We got to do better. This is before this morning's interview. It just seems as if this team seems to be a little flat footed.
Yeah, so let me start by just backing up in terms of saying why I think that this sort of economic argument is less relevant here. So when you look at their trends were exceptionally strong all the way up through October of last year, and then they basically fell off a cliff. That is not what we see when there's pressure on the consumer or they're feeling like the value proposition has changed. You see a slow bleed. The other thing that you typically see is negative mix. So you see check management, consumers, you know, not ordering that extra pump or that that or sizing up. Again, we're not seeing any of that. Actually, check management was absent. Their check was positive, including some price, but also continued, you know, self-selected upselling. So that's why I don't actually think the role of the economy is as pronounced. I think there's some social media narratives that they've also addressed that are much more of the what I will characterize as sort of the acute catalyst for what we've seen.
Sarah, two questions for you really quickly. One is, how much are, you know, sort of smaller mom and pop competition hurting Starbucks? And the second is, are they just having a hard time expanding margins? You mentioned yourself that, you know, you're seeing about 2% inflation on sort of their base level of product. Just can't raise the price of coffee that high. So our margin's a bigger issue.
So to your first question, you know, when we look at data for this industry, for the segment of specialty coffee, it looks like it's been growing call it 7% annually for the last 5 years. That doesn't surprise me because younger consumers just like to consume outside the home. So you would expect to see this, like what I'll call a demographic dividend. It should grow faster than the broader restaurant industry. Starbucks has held share that whole time. So we've seen some shifting, some loss from some regional chains, some gains from, you know, upstarts. But Starbucks itself has been pretty stable. So I don't think it's the mom and pop piece. And, you know, that's a good segue to your second point, which is large chains like Starbucks have a huge cost advantage. So if they're feeling pain, smaller independents are even more so. I think there's a lot of opportunity for margin. I think it comes from self-help. So he talked about throughput. Some of that is, you know, equipment that they're doing. And then some of it is just better staffing, scheduling. So I do think there's an opportunity for them to expand margins even without taking a lot of price.
Just quickly, do you have a sense as to why the occasional customer is just going less? Is it mostly price? Is it the waiting? I'm just trying to figure out how likely is that occasional customer likely to go back and be that occasional customer? Or so, if we should just write them off at this point.
I don't think you should write them off. And in fact, that's always what we see. Whenever Starbucks same-store sales slow, it's typically that customer, right? Because for whatever reason that things are slowing, they're just less loyal. They're less frequent for Starbucks. So if it were economic, which again, I don't think it is, that they would be more likely to maybe give up an occasion. If it's this social media issue, which I think is more likely, they're less tied to the brand and maybe less aware of what the, you know, the true narrative is. So I think they can get them back. I think marketing, I think sort of telling their story is going to be really important.
Sarah, thanks for coming by. Appreciate it. It's good to hear the other side of this. Sarah Senator of Bank of America. What do you think? Is this tempting at these levels, down 15%?
Not quite. I mean, I think we're going to see some people just frustrated throw in the towel and let it settle a little. And it will really turn into a show me story as to having some hope in it, I think.
Mm-hmm. You're a coffee shop owner of two shops, actually. Yeah. What are you seeing in terms of cost and the threat of Starbucks?
Yeah, the in reality, you know, we're actually attracting a lot of customers from Starbucks. People want an alternative, particularly as you move out of the city into the suburbs. They kind of want their smaller, more local chain. So we're actually stealing a lot of customers from Starbucks. I don't think my coffee shop in Rhine
you're the reason.
Is the reason why Starbucks is getting hurt. But with that said, on the margin side, wage pressures are real. Finding really good talent is hard. So, I end up working on Sundays a lot of times because just for that reason.
This stock is now trading at 16 times 25 earnings. Let's be clear. I mean, so and I was actually selling 60 puts out to January because I'll own it there in the current framework. But everything we said tonight, I would have rather heard it was about the consumer. I don't want to hear about it's a company that seems like they're structurally broken or that people have, you know, at some point they have some issues in terms of the pricing of the product. But the competitive landscape, this has been an accident waiting to happen for a year.
There's too many headwinds. There's wages, there's commodities, there's a lot of pricing that's going against them. There's the unions. I think you'll let it sit. If you have to get in, use a $70 stop. And if it trades below that, bail.
I just want to good for her for coming on. It's hard. Yeah. You know, you're bullish. It turned out to be wrong. We all have that. It's just a tough day. Sure. Good for her for coming on.
Coming up, Zillow shares sinking after the house hunting stock's latest quarterly results. We'll take you inside the numbers and the call next. Plus, a brand new survey's one emoji answers are revealing plenty of bullishness among investors, especially if they had an extra 10 grand in their pockets. We sit down with Investopedia's Caleb Silver for a deeper look into investors' minds and wallets right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Let's get to another earnings mover. Zillow zooming lower on its latest quarterly result. That call's underway. Diana Olick joins us now with the very latest. Diana.
Well, Melissa, it was a beat on the top and bottom lines, but weaker than expected Q2 guidance. They blamed that on, big surprise, higher mortgage rates and underperformance among first-time buyers. Now, Zillow's revenue was up 13% year over year, driven by the rental side, primarily multifamily. They said they benefited from occupancy rates coming down off historically high levels, driving more need for advertising. Now, occupancy is down because so much new apartment supply is coming on the market this year. There was mention of the big settlement on commissions with the realtors and brokerages in the shareholder letter. CEO Rich Barton wrote, "The substance of the settlement is what we've characterized as a very very reasonable middle path forward for the industry where commissions are negotiated and communicated between buyers and sellers and both parties are better educated. Melissa?
All right, Diana, thank you. Diana Olick, Karen, this one is in your portfolio.
Yes, just speaking of being on a day when one of your things is down, and I have two to choose from today, but this I thought was actually not a bad quarter. As Diana said, there was a lot to like. It was a little miss on average monthly users, but I thought it was good. EBITDA was very good. The margins were good. I thought the rental was good, which has been a really nice add-on, or over the last 4 or 5 years, that's been a really good business for them. I think of them as in the business of under-promising and over-delivering, and that's what they like to do. So I want to hear the call. It's going on now, so I'll listen to the replay. But nothing to me really would make me shake my interest in this.
Well, they have one side of that equation, right, under-promising. And let's see if they can over-deliver. But when you look at the stock, it's definitely going to be an interest rate event for them. And the stock will probably bottom long before, or at least ahead of time, before we actually see that turn in rates and we go lower in rates. You definitively have to wait for that. I think you have a couple more bucks to the downside, but when there's a premium name in the group and when there's other names, they're definitely the premium name in this group.
Diana mentioned something very interesting. That is a lot of supply, apartment supply coming to market. Obviously, then rents would theoretically go down. Housing costs would come down. Inflation would, in theory, come down. Do you think that's the way it actually unfolds, though?
I mean, theoretically, yes. Mm-hmm. Everybody's just like waiting for Godot. Everybody's waiting for that to happen, you know, and that was the big story coming into the year in terms of disinflation. So I'll believe it when I can see it. Zillow's own home price index is going up, though. So,
all right. See. Coming up, how are investors feeling about the markets and how would you spend an extra $10,000? We're digging into Investopedia's latest investor survey to find out. More Fast Money in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. The survey says that retail investors are cautiously optimistic about the markets, but they were not actually doing much investing in April. That's according to the latest survey from Investopedia. Editor-in-chief Caleb Silver is here on set to dive into the results. It's always nice to see you, Caleb. Why have they backed off?
Well, I think it's funny because investors find a reason to believe one way or the other. They're looking for a reason to believe. They're just not putting their money where their beliefs or their mouth is. They want things to continue to get better. They want the market to continue to rise. Of course, that's the optimism of the herd. But the last first couple weeks of April, some of the slowest inflows into stocks from retail investors since the pandemic, since 2020, that tells you nobody was putting money to work. Some of that is tax season. Some of that is just a lack of appetite. There was a mini little reversal right there. So there's some fear still built in there. They just would like to get more enthusiastic. They're not there yet.
They still like the big stocks, though, in terms of the top reader stocks of April. The usual suspects, ExxonMobil is on that list. And is that a new development? Or
that's always kind of circled the top 10. Sometimes it pops in. Now, it's been a good stock. Oil stocks in general have been good performers. And we've got to remember, a lot of our readers and investors are around 45 years old or older. So they've been in the market a long time. Old faithfuls, dividend-paying stocks, but also these large mega-cap tech stocks. And they say, though, that they're worried some of those are in a bubble, yet they still would buy them if they could.
Yeah, 60% say AI-related stocks are overvalued. So that's interesting, maybe not surprising. In terms of the extra $10,000 question, if you had an extra $10,000, it's still stocks.
Yeah, it's still individual stocks. Remember, this is a stock-loving crowd, individual self-directed investors looking to put money to work. They just haven't had that enthusiasm. There was some dip buying. We did see that at the end of April. But in general, you just don't find that. Let's go. Higher highs mean higher highs. There's uncertainty, and inflation is the top concern. Guess what? It's also the Fed chair's top concern, too. So
we were talking in the break just about some interesting new searches being done in Investopedia. There's some real interest in terms of what's going on in campuses across the country and the protests there, interest in what is an endowment, things like that.
Yeah, people are really waking up to the fact that universities have these multi-billion-dollar endowments, and you've seen some of the protest calls for these universities to divest from companies that are doing business with or for Israel, and some of those are the biggest companies in the world. So it's got prompting a lot of people to search, what does it mean to have an endowment? Where are endowments invested? What does divestment mean? Does divestment work? This has really brought up a lot of conversations about where the big money goes, and we know these universities have a lot of big money.
What about the kind of high uber speculative stuff like Bitcoin, which have had a big pullback and, you know, meme stocks. But, you know, where's the retail investors' appetite for highly spec?
Yeah, they got a lot more interested with the release of the spot Bitcoin ETFs. But I think since then they've seen prices be volatile and then drop quite a bit. So of the 8 or 10% that were already in it, we didn't have a lot more people rushing into it. We have a lot more people being speculative, waiting to see what happens here. Not a big appetite for risk right now, just this cautious optimism. We hope things are going to be okay. Usually they are. We have to see if they will be.
Caleb, thank you. As always, Caleb Silver of Investopedia. Up next, final trades. Final trade time, Michael Kontopoulos.
Short duration, high quality, fixed income.
Tim Seymour.
Nice having Michael. Nice to see healthcare outside of Lilly work. So we talked about J&J, but Pfizer going higher.
Karen.
Yes, Morgan Stanley, and also hello to a longtime watcher, Gavin.
Oh, Gavin, hello.
Hey, Gavin.
Steve?
I went with the IPO today, Viking Holdings, and I'm going to go see Michael on Sunday up in Rye in his coffee shop.
Called Sunshine.
There you go.
Thanks for watching Fast Money. Don't go anywhere. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.